and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Today, a place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Oh, well, thank you for that most gracious introduction, Gouverneur Giuseppe. I haven't talked with you in a while, and we sure have missed you. I hope you have had a wonderful holiday season. But here we are today on the first program of Dare to Think Out Loud in the year of 2022. And I am joined, as usual, by my cohort out there in western Arizona, none other than Cal Robbins himself. Cal, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing good today, Mike, and yourself?
Well, if I was any better, I am sure that I would be illegal in at least 50 states. I'm not sure about the 57 that Obama mentioned earlier. I haven't been able to find out if I'm illegal in those other seven or not, but I am sure that the words that I impart would certainly not be welcome. And also the words that you impart, Cal, would certainly not be welcome on Facebook.
Yeah, we kind of get
or YouTube. Or Twitter, or most of those other social media sites. The truth is banned. I believe we call that censorship. The Nazis did that very well, as did Stalin. So last week, Cal, we got into the discussion of Thomas Jonathan Jackson, better known as Stonewall. And I received some really good feedback from that. I totally believe that if these people aren't talked about, if we don't keep their names alive, the Marxist historians are going to sentence them to oblivion. And there are people who would say, and I've had people say this, well, why do you keep talking about these old people? You know, these things that happened all this time ago. Well, you know, times change, people don't. So if you want a good indicator, as George Santayana once said, those who fail to learn the lessons of history are destined to repeat its mistakes. Would you find that to be accurate, Cal?
Yeah, I find that to be quite accurate. History proves that that's accurate. Of course, you'd have to know history to know that that proves that it's accurate. So it's kind of a revolving circle that keeps you coming back to the same place.
Well, last week we talked about Stonewall Jackson, and, you know, you could probably even today bring up the name of Stonewall Jackson, and you would, especially in the southern climes, you would find a pretty good portion of the people who would understand who Stonewall Jackson was. And that, you know, is, you know, thank goodness that we can still do that. Although, you know, they've torn down his statue at VMI and other places, even though Thomas Jonathan Jackson owned not a single slave and never did. And one of the things we didn't touch on last week was the fact that Jackson, when he saw a law that he thought was immoral or unconstitutional, he pretty well ignored it. And so, contrary to the laws of the day, Stonewall Jackson taught blacks to read and write in the local church. And even when he went off to war, he sent money back to his wife to pay to teach blacks to read and write. And of course, nobody mentioned that when they removed his statue from VMI. So the perversion of history is working on pretty complete, a complete disruption. But today we wanted to talk about another figure from that war for Southern independence, our second war for independence, and the first war for Southern independence. And we're going to talk about another figure who operated that we know most about in the latter part of the war, especially in the Shenandoah Valley, but he was active in the earlier parts of the war, started out as just a private, and then worked through the ranks and was a cavalry officer under Jeb Stuart in several large campaigns, including Fredericksburg and Antietam and a few others. So then he was commissioned to operate his own group called the 43rd Virginia Cavalry. And he operated in northern Virginia with a very close proximity to Washington, D.C., and especially into the Shenandoah Valley during 1864, with some classic confrontations between he and George Custer, who was a Union general. So those are very interesting stories for those who really care about history. So, Cal, what value do you think that we could derive by studying such figures as John Singleton Mosby, the gray ghost of the Confederacy?
Well, to your point, Mosby, I have maybe heard his name once until you brought him up again that we were going to talk about him. So I know way more, even less, about Mosby than I even knew about Stonewall Jackson. So I'm really at a disadvantage because, you know, when you go to study him on a quick study like that, you know, you gotta go, okay, what am I going to read that's going to be truthful and what is not? So I'm kind of hanging on waiting to hear you educate me about Mosby.
Well,
and looking forward to it because I know from experience that everything that you teach has been well researched and sourced and documented.
Well, I appreciate that confidence, Cal. And so Mosby was, again, a very unique individual. And so we found, again, and not to be totally redundant, but he served under Jeb Stuart for quite a while. And Mosby made the comment at one time that only three people knew what he was doing, and that was himself, Jeb Stuart, and Robert E. Lee. Well, I think we must touch on what you and I touched on in the prelude before we came on the air, Cal, And we must talk about the fact that Robert E. Lee did not agree with the tactics of Mr. Mosby. He thought that guerrilla warfare was unmanly. And, of course, we talked about it before. In that era, lining up your men in a straight line and shooting at the enemy who were also lined up in a straight line and blowing each other to pieces with cannon fire was considered to be manly. Early on in the, especially at the Battle of First Manassas, Stonewall Jackson, who we talked about last week, saw the absolute insanity of that type of warfare, considering the advancements in technology of the rifle musket and the exploding cannonball, which was like a huge hand grenade, and also the rifled cannon that came out during this war. And Jackson was one of the first to realize that the tactics that were taught at West Point, listed as Hardee's tactics, were totally useless on the field of battle, considering the advances in technology in 1861 through 1865. So here we had Mosby, who also was not a member of the wealthy aristocracy. He was not a member of the gentry. But he saw, just by common sense, the fact that the South, to win this war, had to resort to guerrilla warfare. Now, in today's parlance, in military speak, we have four generations of warfare. First generation warfare, which is what we saw in the Napoleonic Wars and also in the beginning of the Civil War and also through the Civil War all the way up to Gettysburg and even past that, was the conventional theory that let's all line up in straight lines and shoot at each other. Which, you know, if you stop and think about it, is insanity squared. That's first-generation warfare. Second-generation warfare changed that a bit. But third-generation warfare and fourth-generation warfare, which we find ourselves facing today on the battlefield, is a group of people with definitely finite resources being able to defend themselves, not only that, but to also become aggressive against a much superior foe by using third and fourth generation warfare tactics. Cal, have you ever heard or read very much about fourth generation or third generation warfare tactics at all?
Well, just not in specific, but I would assume that's what in today's parlance they would have called the insurgents over in the Middle East. That's what they were engaged in. Is kind of a behind-the-scenes type of warfare, hit and run. Do not confront the enemy directly because they have superior firepower over you. So you have to hit from a deflection, from an angle. It's just common sense. If you're going to stand up in front, if you're going to stand up with a .22 rifle against somebody with a Barrett 50 caliber, you're going to lose in the battle. So you can't confront them directly like that. In other words, don't charge the castle gates directly.
Well, Cal, a great point, and let's look at a more recent history, which you bring up, is the fact that let's go back 50 years, 60 years. Let's go back to Vietnam. We were fighting a foe on several occasions which never actually presented itself because they were fighting superior weaponry. They were fighting an Air Force. They were fighting a Navy. They were fighting jet pilots and bombers when they didn't have the same thing. But yet, history will show us and will prove to us, how did the Vietnamese, led by Vo Nguyen Giap, a military genius, how did they hold off the power of the United States in what has been referred to as the 10,000-day war? Because if you put it on paper and you say, okay, well, we have all of these bombers, we have this Navy, we have all of this superior stuff, and you don't have very much of any of this, how could you sustain a war for the better part of a decade, Cal?
Once again, you can't confront the enemy directly. You've got to, I mean, it becomes a war of attrition, and you're going to lose more faster by confronting them directly. So you, like I say, you have to hit from angles, so to speak.
Well, Cal, let's look at the war we've been fighting for 20 years now. And we have the strongest military in the world. We have an Air Force, an Army, a Marine Corps, a Navy. We have all of these assets. And yet we have been involved in a war against the Taliban, allegedly, in Afghanistan for the better part of 20 years. And yet we haven't won. How do you explain that? If you had to explain that kind of failure to the American people, of course, the American people still thinks we're winning. How would you explain the fact that in 20 years, a group of people with an Army, a Navy, an Air Force, a Marine Corps could not defeat people with AK-47s and RPGs? How would you explain that?
To be brutally honest, I would tell them because the United States never intended to win. It was all about the military-industrial complex and making money and garnering more control more than winning, because political decisions are made to where the military can't use its might like it should be able to. And so that actually puts the U.S. military at a disadvantage to the tactics of guerrilla warfare.
Well, considering
and that's how they were able to hold them off, is, I mean, they just didn't meet the U.S. military directly head on. And usually when they did, they lost, you know. I mean, bloody fighting in Fallujah in Iraq, but, you know, the United States is going to win in a protracted frontal war like that over some smaller enemy such as Iran or even Iran or Iraq or any of them, just because of the superior firepower and being able to resupply itself.
Well,
ISIS could never resupply itself other than by confiscating other arms that were already on the field. Of course, ISIS was always a project of the CIA and was intended to do what it did anyway. It's really hard to compare a war from civil war, where it was really a war fighting over ideology, to where now it's just a war for show to keep the American people going along with the game.
Well, Cal, did we fund the Taliban?
Yes.
Created. Beginning when?
Back in the Carter era.
Oh, 1978. Oh, and who was responsible for that? Oh, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. He would eventually become Secretary of Defense. At that time, he was second in command of the CIA. And so in 78, we send $500 million to the Muslim Brotherhood so that they can defend themselves against Russia. And then we end up fighting the enemy we funded.
The enemy we created.
Yes. So, and then, of course, Robert Gates and Zbigniew Brzezinski. And Brzezinski said, I'm trying to think, I wrote an article about that one time, but Brzezinski says, you know, what do we have to fear from a bunch of Muslims anyway? That's what he said in 78. So why not send them $500 million taxpayer dollars so that they can fund their army? And here's the thing that it's hard to teach people to do, and I know we're getting away from John Singleton Mosby here, but I think this is important. America funds enemies 20 to 30 years in advance so they'll have somebody to fight. And no matter how many times they keep doing this, Bubis Americanus can't catch on to the fraud, Cal.
No, they don't seem to be able to. The reason they do that is one, it funds the military-industrial complex, and two, wars such as that tend to consolidate power around the executive office of any government, around the executive, whether it be a king, a president, a prime minister, or whatever. And that tends to consolidate power, and people, you know, well, we're at war, you got to be patriotic, you got to go along with what's being said. Or they'll even pass laws and throw you in jail, which they did, during the Civil War. And they did during the Adams administration, the first Adams administration with the Alien Sedition Act. So, they do this on purpose. I mean, the powers that be are doing this on purpose. And that's what most people still are trying to come to terms with. That this whole war in the Middle East was contrived and dreamed up by the powers that be and put into effect by the CIA and Mossad.
Wait a minute, Cal. Are you quoting, are you supporting James Madison here?
It depends on what Madison said.
Well, I mean, let's look at what old little Jimmy Madison had to say. He said, of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. James Madison, Political Observations, April the 20th, 1795. Wow, Cal, you quoted Mr. Madison, or you espoused his philosophy.
Well, it's true.
Well,
yeah. It doesn't matter who said it. It matters that it's the truth.
Well,
that's how evil works, is it tells the truth and then just twists it a little bit. But rooted in it, there has to be a truth. And yeah, Madison was absolutely right. I mean, he was a political genius, and he played both sides of the coin perfectly, and he was playing that side of the coin right there, and he nailed it, knocked it out of the park. That's absolutely true.
Wow, and yes, and that's the point that I think of so many times, is sometimes we just discount out of hand something that someone says because of who said it, without weighing the words themselves or the ideas themselves, and we discount it because of the presenter or the author of the comment. And I'm no fan of James Madison at all. I very much am upset at him and his history of what he did in this country, and the false accolades that we give him as the father of the Constitution and the father of the Bill of Rights, which I think are both very poorly addressed. But even at that, as you said, and writing as Helvetius against Alexander Hamilton as Pacificus, when Madison was writing as Helvetius, he did some very good points at that time, too. So, and that is one of the reasons I have referred to James Madison as the Bill Clinton of the founding era. Your thoughts, Cal?
Exactly. No, I agree completely. I mean, Madison knew how to play the game on both sides. And like I said, right there, he was – those are words of wisdom for anybody. You know, I mean, even Hamilton said stuff that is like, well, you got to agree with him on this, you know. Doesn't just because you agree with somebody on something doesn't mean you agree with them on everything. I've never understood that that philosophy. Well, you know, it's like, you know, the whole Trump card phenomenon. You know, Trump did this one good thing, so he did a good thing. So now everything he does is good if you're on the Trump side, or everything he does is bad on the other side, and there's no objectivity in it at all. It's all under emotion instead of under reason. And unfortunately, most people follow emotion before reason.
Well, that is true. Most people don't think with their brain. They think with something else. One of the things that happened earlier on, and I do want to get into John Singleton Mosby, who was known as the Gray Ghost, and he operated guerrilla warfare in the northern part of Virginia and down through the Shenandoah Valley, and was many times in very close proximity of Washington, D.C. And I don't think that any part of Mosby could be discussed about what I think is one of the greatest stories, one of the greatest anecdotes of the Second War for Independence. And that would be that which occurred on none other than March the 9th of 1863. And this is before Mosby was really that well known. But Mosby had in his mind the capture of a Union colonel who was known as Sir Percy Wyndham. Wyndham was a British soldier of fortune fighting for the North. And he disapproved of Mosby's guerrilla style tactics, and in the months preceding this event is alleged to have slandered Mosby by labeling him as a simple horse thief. Well, Mosby was incensed, and he intended to capture Mr. Wyndham as a prize for the South. And in December of 1862, which was a bad year for the Union, Acting Brigadier General Edwin Henry Stoughton of Bellows Falls, Vermont, the newly appointed commander of the 2nd Vermont Brigade, had moved his headquarters to Fairfax, Virginia, in what is called Fairfax Courthouse. And so Stanton had recently been nominated for Brigadier General by Lincoln, but had not yet been confirmed by the United States Senate. At 24, Stanton was then the youngest brigadier general in the U.S. Army, U.S. Army. The 2nd Vermont Brigade, composed of the 12th, the 13th, 14th, the 15th, and 16th Vermont infantry regiments, were encamped in tents several miles to the south of Fairfax Courthouse along Wolf Run Shoals on the Occoquan River and Union Mills along Bull Run. In addition to his headquarters guard and the troops detached to the provost marshal of Fairfax Courthouse, General Stanton was very much involved in the defense around Washington, D.C., and a defense that had been thrown up because of the exploits of none other than Stonewall Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley. And so the president sent a message, Mr. Lincoln sent a message to General Stoughton, and he says, I hope that you have all of the successful start to the new year, starting with 63. We're looking forward to another full year of events. The first big event will be Mosby's raid and reenactment, and blah, 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 blah. Well, anyway, we're jumping ahead there. So what happened during this is just absolutely amazing. And that was the fact that Mosby brought several of his men into the area to capture Colonel Wyndham. And so they actually infiltrated, guerrilla warfare here, they actually infiltrated The camp, the tent camp. And they went in. And they were searching for Windham. And so we're looking at the fact that here we have a firm Union encampment. And Mosby and several of his men are able to infiltrate into that encampment, certainly not wearing Confederate uniforms, but being fully involved in guerrilla warfare, they move into the area. And they come in and they come to a tent. They ask, where's the commanding officer, which they thought was Windham. And so they said, okay, the Union soldiers would point these men to a tent and said, there's where the commander's tent is. So Mosby and his men enter the tent of General Stoughton. And so he's lying asleep on his cot. And so Mosby takes out his saber and he slaps General Stoughton right across the ass with his saber, the flat part. And Stoughton immediately jumps to, you know, he's awakened out of a deep sleep and he goes, What's going on? What's going on here? And Mosby said, well, have you ever heard of John Mosby? And General Stoughton says, yes, yes. Have you captured him? And Mosby says, no, General, but he has captured you. So Mosby in guerrilla warfare moves into the middle of a strong Union fortification and captures their general and takes him out. Now, Cal, how could the same thing be accomplished in standard Generation 1 or Generation 2 warfare? Cal, you muted yourself there, buddy. You're still muted, Cal. There you are.
I keep hitting the button too many times. I suppose it could be carried out at any time. You know, special forces could probably do something like that.
But wouldn't that be considered guerrilla type warfare?
Well, that's what the Navy SEALs and, you know, the Marine Special Forces, that's what they engage in. Covert warfare, mostly for the CIA.
Okay, so let me tell you this, and I can promise you this, since Vietnam, the CIA has controlled and commanded both the Navy SEALs, Marine Force Recon, and U.S. Army Rangers and U.S. Army Special Forces, Green Berets. The CIA has been in control of them unequivocally since Vietnam.
Yeah, they're the military force for the CIA, basically. That's when they don't use their own black ops forces or their own assets to do it, yeah.
So
they use mercenary forces as well. So
oh, yes.
whatever they need to do to get their job done.
Yeah, like the Hoang in Vietnam, they used the Chinese. They used several others. And then, unfortunately, like we always do at the end of the war, we left the Hmong and others in the hands of their enemy. But anyway, here is Mosby making this kind of raid. And so he goes in and captures a Union general. So it certainly enhanced his credentials, if you want to call them that. It certainly enhanced his credentials. Easy for me to say, right? Let's look at Colonel Mosby and his operations inside of the Shenandoah Valley. And let's think about what Mosby had to say. And as I said before, a direct quote from Colonel Mosby, the Gray Ghost, was only three men in the Confederate Army knew what I was doing or intended to do, and they were Lee and Stuart and myself. That's a direct quote from Mosby. Cal, you know, one of the things I found ironic, I believe it was in the 1950s, there was actually a TV series on the exploits of John Singleton Mosby. What do you think the chances of that happening today are?
Slim to none.
You think there's even a slim?
Yeah. But slim, okay, leaning way more towards none. No chance.
Well, you know, not a particularly enthusiastic soldier. Even when he enlisted as a private in 1861, Mosby disliked routine Army life. After seeing action at First Manassas, Mosby was promoted to First Lieutenant in the 1st Virginia Cavalry Regiment, and enjoying the cavalry, which he thought was, yeah, this is the way to go. But he was bored with the administrative parts, and as being a regimental adjutant, he just was not happy with that at all. He did not want to be a political soldier. So Mosby resigned and became attached to the staff of General Jonathan Edward Brown Jeb Stuart, then the cavalry commander of the Confederate Army that soon became the Army of Northern Virginia. And Mosby would later write in a letter, and I quote, he said that Stuart made me all that I was in the war, the best friend that I ever had. Mosby proved his worth as a scout and intelligence collector during the Peninsula Campaign in June of 1862. Now, Cal, are you familiar with that campaign with Jeb Stuart on the peninsula in 1862?
No, I'm not. What peninsula? I'm not even, don't even know what peninsula they're speaking of.
Well, they're in Virginia. And what they were talking about was the fact that Jeb Stuart, now this was heralded at the time, but people don't mention it today, that Jeb Stuart took about 1,200 Confederate cavalrymen and made a complete circle around the Union Army. He rode completely around them, and ironically, his father-in-law was a commander of one of the units there, of course. You know, who would want even care about that type of history today? But Mosby scouted ahead and along for Stuart during Second Manassas, Antietam, and Fredericksburg. And he proposed to Stuart the idea of leading a band of riders to conduct guerrilla warfare in Northern Virginia. Mosby convinced Stuart, and then Stuart convinced Robert E. Lee to authorize a company of Rangers in January of 1863. As the unit grew and gained notoriety, it eventually became Company A of the 43rd Battalion of Virginia Cavalry, or as we should know them today, Mosby's Rangers. So although guerrillas or partisan rangers, as they were called back then, Mosby's men were subject to the Articles of War and Army regulation within General Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Yes, wars must have rules, which are never followed. After a year of successful raids to harass the enemy, gather intelligence, and strike Union supply lines east of Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains, a new federal threat appeared west of the Blue Ridge in the breadbasket of the Confederacy, which was the Shenandoah Valley. On August the 7th of 1864, now guys, we're well into the war here. Major General, this is after Gettysburg. This is after many of the major battles. So Major General Philip Sheridan took command of the Union Army of the Shenandoah with orders from General Ulysses S. Grant to conduct total war, which is totally against the Geneva Convention. But they were ordered to wipe out Confederate resistance in the Shenandoah Valley and to burn crops and farms. Sheridan launched an offensive on August the 9th with a force of nearly 40,000 troops and a wagon train about 12 miles long. Sheridan's army was imposing, but to guerrilla tactics, it was vulnerable. So standing in Sheridan's Avenue to Conquest was, believe it or not, the 14,000-man Confederate Army of the Valley under Lieutenant General Jubal Early, a very adept Southern commander. Now, here's something I found unusual in doing the research, Cal. As Mosby twice offered his services to Early, and Early did not respond. Ignoring Early's indifference, Mosby decided to stretch his resources to defend the valley anyway. And his quote was, he intended to vex and embarrass Sheridan and to prevent his advance into the interior of the state of Virginia. Mosby was acting on his own because his best friend and his mentor, Jonathan Edward Brown Stuart, had been killed in action on May the 12th of 1864. Mosby got his first chance to attack Sheridan early on August the 13th of 1864. With intelligence from his scouts, Mosby gathered 300 Rangers and rode into the Shenandoah Valley to ambush Sheridan's column. At sunrise, Mosby's force struck just north of Berryville, and although most of the Federals had passed along by that point, the wagon train of the Union Cavalry Corps was vulnerable. The Rangers fired two cannon rounds, then charged into the unsuspecting Union troops. Those who were not captured or killed scattered. Mosby's men seized over 200 Federal soldiers. Well, now, they only had 300 men themselves. But now listen to what they captured. Over 200 Federal soldiers, 500 horses or mules, 200 head of cattle, and 100 wagons. After the wagons were plundered, Mosby ordered them burned. Furious about what became known as the Berryville Wagon Train Raid, Sheridan dedicated an entire brigade to wagon train security. And he armed those soldiers with the new 7-shot Spencer repeating carbines. Sheridan also acquired the scouting and counter-guerrilla services of a 100-man unit known as Blazer Scouts, under the command of Captain Richard Blazer. So, Cal, what do you see happening here so far?
The tactics of warfare are changing. Lessons to be learned here in conducting warfare.
Okay. All right. Very much understood.
I mean, Sheridan responded. I mean, he's got now a small guerrilla force of 100 soldiers under Blazer, basically doing the same thing. So, well, he's, you know, conducting, not, is it unmanly or ungentlemanly? Because they fought wars on a gentleman's principle, you know, lining up and shooting each other, and it wasn't gentlemanly to sneak up behind them and attack them from the rear, so to speak, or to capture their wagon trains, which is exactly where you should go to start with.
Well, that is true, but it was General Robert E. Lee who said that it was unmanly as well as ungentlemanly guerrilla warfare. But the conflict between Mosby's Rangers and Sheridan, now remember, Mosby had, what, 300-400 men? Sheridan had 40,000? So Mosby's Rangers and Sheridan's troops in the valley became increasingly brutal. In retaliation for the wagon train raid, Sheridan's cavalry burned barns, crops, and mills. Now, if you go to the War of the Records of the Rebellion, you will find that these men, not only these Union soldiers traveling through the Shenandoah Valley, not only burned barns, crops, and mills, but they also raped the black women who were present and debauched the white women. I'm not exactly sure what the difference is there. But that is actually in the official records. This was the all-out war that Grant had ordered, total war. Now, Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer, he ordered the burning of 5 Berryville properties, including the homes of several people, because of Mosby's raid on the wagons. Now, somebody tell me how that is manly or gentlemanly, that 300 men move in and kick your ass and take your, you know, take prisoners and take part of your, and so then you turn your army loose on the civilian population. Now, how many times are we taught about that in good old public fool system, Cal?
Come on, there, mute button. No, it's not talked about. It's not taught. I mean, the closest they get is just a mere mention of Sherman's March to the Sea. That's as close to total warfare as most people understand. Most people don't understand it under today's terms. That would totally be considered a war crime. In fact, they knew they were committing what were called war crimes back then. They knew if the Union lost people like Sherman, they'd have been hung for their actions.
Well, wow, imagine that, Cal. Sherman actually said that.
Yeah.
Sherman said that had the South prevailed, he, Grant, and Lincoln would have been hanged for war crimes, as he had been taught what war crimes were at West Point.
Yeah. So you're seeing an evolution in warfare through the Civil War. For those who like to study tactics and stuff like that, there is an evolution happening here. It didn't catch on and continued all the way through World War One, but the evolution was started into getting to that third and fourth generation of warfare you spoke about.
Well, as troopers of Custer's 5th Michigan Cavalry Regiment began to torch the house of Benjamin Morgan on August the 19th, three companies of Mosby's Rangers under Captain William Chapman attacked. And seeing what was happening to the civilian population, William Chapman, Captain William Chapman, leading these troops, ordered, and his orders were, wipe them from the face of the earth. No quarter, no prisoners. Well, depending on where you look in the official records, at least 20 Federals were killed and 10 were captured. Now, here's what happened. Because of their committing of total war, the prisoners were allegedly executed, two with their throats cut. One survivor lived to tell the gory tale. So Sheridan's advance into the Shenandoah Valley stopped because of this. The Army of the Shenandoah returned to the Harper Ferries area, with Mosby's Rangers harassing it along the way. By early September of 1864, Sheridan launched a new offensive, this time with improved security for his supply train. Mosby, however, had plans to intercept and strike the Federal advance. Leading two companies of Rangers himself, Mosby sent two more companies under Captain Samuel Chapman into the valley on September the 2nd. Early the next morning, hearing reports of Union troops near Berryville, Chapman approached the town from the southwest and met the 6th Union Cavalry Regiment, a lead element of Sheridan's forces. Facing off in a farm field owned by the Gold family about 1/2 mile south of Berryville, Virginia, Chapman split his companies into two attack wings and charged, yelling and screaming. Although armed with Spencer 7-shot repeating carbines, the New Yorkers were killed, captured, or scattered. Union casualties were reportedly 42, while Mosby lost 5. After less than a month, Mosby's combat tactics in the valley were established. Always attack and use terror to gain an advantage, always on the offensive, quoted Mosby. At the order to charge, my men dashed forward with a yell that startled and stunned the enemy. It was safer being the aggressor and striking the enemy at unguarded points. Perfect for this fighting style were Mosby's Rangers, most of whom were between the ages of 17 and 25. And these young men sought the glory of war on horseback. Ranger John Munson wrote, one of Mosby's men, "Usually a young fellow who joined Mosby's command came with romantic ideas of the partisan ranger's existence. Adding to the lure of ranger life, Mosby allowed his troops to keep everything they plundered from these raids." And Mosby would say, "If men got rewards of horses and arms, they were more devoted to the cause. A few rangers carried other weapons, but Mosby favored the 1860 Colt Army revolver because it provided close combat firepower without being cumbersome. As Mosby said, I had no faith in the saber as a weapon. We did more than any other body of men to give the Colt pistol its great reputation." Comments, Cal?
Looks like Mosby was the first one to employ the tactics of shock and awe. Or blitzkrieg. I mean, some people did learn from stuff. I mean, part of, you know, military studies is studies of tactics of, you know, other generals and other battles. And it looks like some people learned from those lessons and some people haven't. But, you know, shock and awe, it worked. It worked for Mosby. It worked in Iraq at first until they decided to pull back. But that's second. I guess that's your third and fourth generation type of warfare you were talking about.
Well, I think it's really critical to study this and to know about it because this became very, very brutal. And I remember traveling there in the 80s, you know, from 82 to 87, especially in the Shenandoah Valley, many times in performance of my duties. And stopping at various places and looking at these battlefields and going into courthouses and looking at the official records, the ones that survived, that is, many of the courthouses were burned later on. But despite the, you know, that wonderful appeal of young men of riding with Mosby, it was certainly dangerous to be a ranger. After Union victories at 3rd Winchester and Fisher's Hill, rangers entered the valley seeking ways to disrupt Sheridan's lines of communication. In a fight near Front Royal, Virginia, on September the 22nd, rangers under Captain Sam Chapman mistakenly attacked a much larger force of Union cavalry escorting an ambulance convoy. In the ensuing firefight, the Federals captured 6 rangers. And during this fight, allegedly, a Union officer was shot down while trying to surrender by Mosby's forces. Now, let's not forget, we'd already turned this thing into total war. The furious Federals wanted to take revenge against the 6 captured Rangers, and they were granted permission by George Armstrong Custer. And so, or either him or Major General Alfred Torbert. All 6 victims were either shot or hanged, and 3 were buried in Front Royal's Prospect Hill Cemetery. A 7th captured ranger was executed later. So here we have it. Here's the beginning. Still, harassing raids continued in the valley until October the 14th when Mosby and approximately 80 rangers conducted the Greenback Raid near Duffield's Station, about 7 miles west of Harper's Ferry. Wanting to create a spectacular event, Mosby and his men removed a rail from the railroad and waited for the next westbound train to derail. When it did, Mosby's rangers entered the cars, killed a Union officer, and confiscated personal valuables from all of the passengers. Now, who started this total war? Anyway, after the passengers were removed, rangers burned the train. Inside the train's paymaster box was $173,000 in cash, Cal. And Mosby confiscated this $173,000 and divided it between his ranger participants. These men were given about $2,100 each. but this certainly disturbed the union authorities. Thoughts, Cal?
I guess what it's showing is the escalation of the brutalities of war into total war. Keep going with the story, Mike. I'm enjoying it.
Well, once you cross that line.
Yeah, once you cross a certain line, it's like, why turn back?
Well, can you ever put the toothpaste back in the tube?
No. No. And so, that's one of the lessons to learn about the horrors of war is that it can very quickly turn into total war to where civilians, property, anything else, everything is fair game. There is no real rules of engagement. It can devolve. Would that be a proper word? Devolve into that quickly, or evolve into that quickly?
I think evolve would be the proper word, Cal.
Well, war itself is a de-evolution of man. We're supposed to get along with each other, not kill each other. At least I thought that was the story I've been taught.
Well, Cal, getting along with each other does not produce huge profits for a military-industrial complex.
No, and it doesn't centralize power, and it doesn't garner control to those who wish to be in control of others. No. All of that is antithetical to peace and prosperity and liberty.
Okay. Well, we're about to reach the top of the hour here, and stop and think about other things you might want to broach in the second hour about Mr. Mosby and the gray ghost of the Confederacy. And we'll
Great,
touch
I
on
do
that
have some questions.
We'll
do,
touch on that a little bit more. Plus, how about we ring in our old buddy from out there in Utah, Dale Williams?
Oh, excellent. Yes. Dale's out there. I'd love to have him here.
All right. So when we come back on the after the top of the hour, we'll see if we can have Brother Dale in here with us to talk about this subject. Oh, there it is. Here we are, top of the hour. Be back on the flip side, folks. Thanks for joining us with Dare to Think Out Loud.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Fripp Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rips, I've been thinking. Welcome to the Crypt.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. with your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm. As expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Hey, Mike. Good morning. Good afternoon, your time.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, folks, here to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the 7th day of January in the brand new year of 2022. And during the break there, we were welcomed in our friend from out in Salt Lake City, Utah, a multi-year host, talk show host on K-Talk Radio. And unfortunately, my good friend Dale Williams made the fatal mistake of speaking the truth. Dale, how are you, buddy?
I'm really good, Mike. Weather has moderated a little bit out here. We come out of our holes for a couple hours, so, and I'm glad to be talking to you, which is always always a highlight in my week or my month. So,
well, thank you, my friend. I really appreciate that. And we also have our good buddy Cal. You're familiar with Cal, right?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we ended the first hour.
Is it good or bad?
Well, we'll explore that subject at a later date.
Okay.
But anyway, we went into the some of the discussion of John Singleton Mosby, the man known as the Gray Ghost of the Confederacy, and we at the end of the hour, Cal said he had a couple of questions. So Dale, let's see what Cal's questions are.
My question is kind of based on armchair quarterback or generalship armchair quarterbacking. What was Mosby's role when Lee went into Pennsylvania and ended up in Gettysburg? Where was Mosby during all this? Was he with Jeb Stuart?
He was scouting for Stuart. Yes, that would be correct.
Okay. So when Stuart did, Stuart was trying to make another loop around the Union lines, and he was gone from Lee longer than he should have been, so Lee wasn't quite sure where Meade was.
Well,
is that accurate?
That would be accurate.
Like I said, the history I know of the Civil War, I have to question because so much of it out there is false. So another question is, once Meade committed to confront Lee, how exposed was Washington, D.C.?
Well, that was the classic point, and that ended up being the huge battle between Longstreet and Lee on the night of July the 2nd. That was because Longstreet kept saying, look, we have lured the Union Army into Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Let's make a flanking movement and come between Meade and Washington, D.C. Now, there's two ways of looking at yes, of course, Jeb Stuart was criticized for not being able to tell Lee exactly where Meade was, because Jeb Stuart had been considered the eyes and ears of Lee's military movements. But let's not forget that part of Jeb Stuart's orders, too, were to disrupt the supply lines for the Union Army. And he was heavily engaged in doing just that. He and General Wade Hampton were very much involved in disrupting the supply trains that were going to Meade. So it would be hard to say that, in my mind, that Jeb Stuart was neglecting his duty. By attacking these wagon trains and seizing these wagon trains of supplies, he was taken away from the intelligence gathering that Lee needed. But to me, that's just the fortunes of war. I can't blame Jeb Stuart for that. What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's I wouldn't be blaming Jeb Stuart. He's doing what he had to do. I mean, when you're outdoing what you're supposed to be doing, that's what you focus on. It just, you know, like I say, it's easier to look back in hindsight and look at it from a perspective of not being there, but having being able to see the final conclusion in the whole picture gives you a different perspective than what, say, Jeb Stuart or Lee or anybody else or even Meade had at that time. You know, I have a 20/20 vision of it, you know, through going through, you know, the reports and all that, as to where they only had what was happening exactly in front of them. So, yeah, it would be unfair to criticize Jeb Stuart, but it does seem in retrospect he could have sent, you know, one or two or three messengers to inform Lee that Meade had committed a large chunk of his army into Pennsylvania, which, you know, that would just looking at it, that would say, well, that means he's left his flank open, which that flank being Washington, D.C. Of course,
well, that is
the same thing is true with Lee leaving Richmond, is now they've left their flank of Richmond exposed as well. You know, these are just tactics of war. I'm just going through these tactics, you know, in my head, playing out these scenarios in my head. It's like, well, what if Lee had known that Meade was committed and he would have gone and attacked, you know, D.C.? What if he had captured D.C.? What if he had captured Lincoln? Didn't have to kill him. If he had captured him, the South could have sued for peace. You know,
well,
because this is just retroflect. I'm not, and this isn't a criticization of any of the generals in the armies, because they only have the information of what's in front of them. That's just, you know, that's just one of those what if questions. You know, what if Lee would have had Jeb Stuart harass D.C.? Would that have held Meade in D.C.? And Lee could have, you know, ravaged through Pennsylvania, because a lot of part of why Lee went there was to give the Shenandoah Valley a break from the travesties of war, because, you know, war is devastating, especially back then, on the local communities that are involved in it. I mean, farms are, you know, taken over, farms or crops are destroyed, cattle are killed or captured. You know, all of this, you know, goes on in war. It, especially back then. And so that would have given Lee more of a free rein in Pennsylvania, or since Meade committed, that would have exposed the flank of D.C. And I'm just playing armchair quarterback looking at this, and so I was wondering what Mosby's role was in this. And so it sounds like Longstreet was on, you know, would agree. It's like, well, wait a minute, we've exposed – Meade's committed. They've exposed their flank. Let's take advantage of it and end the war. And then you start to wonder, well, were they really trying to end the war?
Well, what you speak to here, Cal, is exactly the movement that Longstreet proposed at that time, the flanking movement around Little Round Top and cutting off Meade from Washington, D.C., was exactly the same type maneuver 2 months earlier that Stonewall Jackson had authorized against Stonewall Jackson had proposed. Not authorized, proposed against Hooker at Chancellorsville, and it proved to be devastating. They could have driven, if they would have had a few more hours of daylight, they could have driven the Union Army right into the Rappahannock River.
That gives another great what if, you know. What if Stonewall hadn't have been killed prior to Gettysburg?
Well, that's
he would have been there he would have been there to suggest this to Lee, and Lee, listening to Stonewall Jackson more than Longstreet, might have swayed it differently. These are just, you know, the great what ifs in history. It's hard not to play what ifs every now and then in history. You go in and you look at it objectively, but sometimes you step out and you just play a what if every now and then. And it just helps you getting perspective on everything, I guess.
Exactly. Dale, your thoughts, sir?
Well, the subject of Mosby is as new to me as this morning. Admit that up front, but I was struck by the material I was able to consume this morning on the subject. I was struck by how ready the Union Army was to destroy prisoners taken from the formations that Mosby commanded on the basis that they were irregular, and the order was out for summary execution. No trial. If somebody couldn't prove if one of Mosby's people was captured and there was no evident sign of his affiliation, his loyalty or membership, you know, in a unit or whatever, dead. And, you know, that's the way the Union rolled. And if anything, they were even harder on civilians toward the end, Mike, if that's my understanding. So life got really cheap toward the end.
Well, you know, we mentioned that, and, you know, how can we mention the horrors of war without talking about Sherman's march to the sea from Atlanta to Savannah? But how many people know that the, you know, that this is listed, Sherman's march to the sea is listed at the Smithsonian Institute as the fourth worst ecological disaster in American history?
I don't think that modern people, and myself included, have the means, unless you've done some kind of subsistence farming, you know, primitive type farming, or at least 19th century style farming, you cannot appreciate what happens when an army, like this rogue army of the I almost said Sheridan, that would work too because he was in the middle of it, but of Sherman going through and destroying the livelihood. In other words, what it took in the 19th century to get a farmstead in a running condition where it could sustain the life of a mother, a father, and a few children, maybe grandparents, and provide a decent quality of life. It was an amazing outlay of energy and persistence, and it was a fragile thing. And then you had these, this army that had gone rogue, come through and destroy everything. And as you pointed out to me, in these unbelievable forwards that of Sherman's personal correspondence that Mike, that you afforded to me years past, who would know what monsters these Union generals were? And you just have to look at the whole lash up, the damn railroads and banks and their lawyers that ran Lincoln, and that whole what a cesspit it had to be that got control. And this was my journey towards my present cynical view of this country, that the scum de la scum rises to the top always and runs the thing. But yeah, it was a Holocaust that they inflicted down there in Georgia. I don't think it's a bad thing to go over. I wonder.
Wow, did you skip out on us, Dale, there? Uh-oh. Did we lose him, Cal?
Yeah, it showed that he left. He'll probably call us back. Yeah, he was on a great point. I think that's, you know, something when people look at this, they don't understand how devastating an army roaming through your area of the woods, so to speak, can be upon your livelihood. What a threat it really was to the civilian population. There you go. All right.
Good to have you back, buddy. Yeah, finish out your thought there, Dale.
Well, see, and this is what happens when I overcaffeinate, but I was actually coming to a period there, and I appreciate the fact, Mike, that you peeled a lot of scales off my eyes, but I think about what happened at the end of towards the end of the war and then under Reconstruction, but I still think I only apprehend the tip of the iceberg. Go ahead.
Well, Dale, I think it's important that we realize that with Sherman, this was not new, because in 1862 in Mississippi, Sherman ordered the town of Meridian, Mississippi, burned to the ground. He said, I don't want a house left standing. This is in 1862. This is within a year after the war started, and he burned the entire town, and there were no Confederate military forces present. That was just open warfare against the civilian population. And then you mentioned Sheridan in his campaign in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864. He sent a message to President Lincoln stating that I have devastated this valley to the point that if a crow flies from one end to the other, it will have to carry a lunch.
Well, and the Shenandoah Valley was the breadbasket. So
it was.
Basically, what you're looking at is a starvation of the people of that area. And well, the Shenandoah, being the breadbasket, is also fed other areas. So we're looking at, you know, starvation and the diseases that come with malnutrition that go along with it, intentionally inflicted upon a civilian population.
Well,
the government people brag about.
One of the things that always amazes me, Cal, is when and I was just thunderstruck at the National Archives when I first saw those 128 volumes. That's 128 full volumes called The War of the Rebellion. Now, this is not records kept by the South. These are records kept by the Union government. And if you delve into those books, those volumes, and start reading about the depredations that were brought on the Southern people by the Union Army from day one. And it ended up being terrible with that March to the Sea. But this was something that was being done from the beginning, especially going into civilians' homes and stealing their goods and raping the women. This began very early on. This was an army of Marxists. They were led by Marxists, and they conducted a Marxist war on the South. And today we built a damn monument for that bastard along the banks of the Potomac. Sorry, but I get kind of fired up about this. Jump in here, Dale.
Well, the dead tell no tales, do they? So we don't even know. I mean, we don't know how many people died of effective starvation or malnutrition in the early 1930s in this country. And it's suppressed. So now you got to go back another 70 years in this set of depredations. I don't know. I mean, I do know.
Uh-oh. Sounds like Del did too much coffee again. Mike, are you there?
I'm here, Cal. You go ahead and talk.
This is an amazing sequence with the phone. Got to make you wonder, but I mean, nothing I'm saying is that important. But I guess there's a mischief maker somewhere in the amongst our unseen companions here. This thing went on. This business of suppressing the South went on before the war, and then for generations after the war. And of course, once the mind control instrument of Hollywood got up on its hind legs and was producing a lot of films, the stereotyping of the South as basically a degenerate culture goes on to this day.
No, very well stated, Cal.
It's to Dell's point. I mean, yeah, the deprivation they did. Don't forget the blockade, the Union blockade on trade, so that the Union or so that the South could not do trade by ship. You know, it killed the trade of cotton with England. You know, and that was a source of revenue for the South. So yeah, there was, you know, and you know, a blockade upon another country is an act of war. Of course, they were in a war, but and what that does is that hurts the civilian population as well as the military. Of course, that's part of the point: get the civilian population to go against your military. It's a part of the psychological aspects of war.
Well, one of the things I would like to see, guys, is I would like to see people do, and I certainly didn't read it all. Let me say that up front. But let me tell you something. I do not believe that anyone should believe any historian or any broadcaster or any politician who talks about the war between the states, the Second War for Independence, or the war for Southern independence. No one should make one reference to that if they haven't read, and I quote, "The War of the Rebellion, a compilation of the official records of the Union and Confederate armies, 128 volumes with an atlas, which is at the Washington Government Printing Office, and it was made, compiled from 1880 to 1901. These are official U.S. government records. They were not records compiled by anyone from the Confederacy. Therefore, if the government people is your God, these documents should be your scriptures." And what is actually there, and let me read you just a few examples. Here is a letter from John T.K. Hayward, who was a Unionist and the general agent of the Hannibal and St. Joseph Railroad, in a letter to J.W. Brooks of Boston, and who was forwarded to Secretary of War Simon Cameron on August the 27th of 1861. People were 1 month into the war. 1 month. Now listen to this war. Listen to this letter, an excerpt from this letter that was sent from a Union man to another Union man that was forwarded to the Secretary of War. Now listen to this quote. "In northern Missouri, the irregularities of the soldiery, such as taking poultry, pigs, milk, butter, preserves, potatoes, horses, and in fact everything they want, entering and searching houses, committing rapes on the Negroes, and such like things. The effect has been been to make a great many Union men inveterate enemies, and no punishment or none of any account has been meted out to them. Drunkenness is the great curse of officers and men." Unquote. You will find that in volume number 49, page 1139. Now, how can you read that a month into this war? How can you read that rapes on Negroes. How can you read this and then honor Lincoln and his fantastic army or his frickin' government? And here's another one for you. On May 18th, 1862, in Northeast Virginia, Colonel Herman Haupt of the Union Army sent the following dispatch to General McDowell, and I quote, "Guerrillas are forming in various parts of the country provoked by rapes and other crimes committed by the Union men. Any violence offered a female, white or colored, with the attempt to commit a rape should be punished accordingly," unquote. Wow. So this is what the Union Army is doing from the beginning, and we're supposed to salute that flag, pledge allegiance to that flag that they were fighting under. And then when this is over, gentlemen, they turn this same damn hateful army loose on the American Indian. How can we accept this? Go ahead, Cal, before I get really fired up.
No, it's good to get fired up. I mean, yeah, accepted is the truth. It's that it's been glorified and turned, let's just say they've sanitized it to where the depredations and the actual horrors have been cleaned from the narrative in understanding exactly what had happened. I mean, most people, I mean, me being one of them, have never actually been in the horrors of war. I know you served as a grunt in Vietnam, Mike, so you've seen it firsthand. You know what it can be like. And I think part of that, you know, the deaths of, 22 servicemen a day still happening, suicides, is part of just somebody not being able to reconcile that, what they've done, what's expected of someone in war as compared to in civilization, and they just can't reconcile that in their mind. And I'm sure it's tough. I really got to be careful because, like I say, not having served in the military or been overseas and fighting somebody, I don't know the exact horrors of it. I can only imagine what it would be. But most people don't even have any contemplation of what it was like. I mean, back then, you couldn't go to the grocery store when you ran out of food and buy food. You had to store enough food to get through the winter. And if the army came along and destroyed that storage, odds were you were going to starve to death and die that winter. And that's just, that was just a matter of life and death back then. And it's hard to imagine being in that position, though it seems to be we're fast approaching that again.
Sure, Cal, they'd even take your damn firewood, and destroy the roof over your head. So there might be some masonry left of your house, but there's no shelter there. And what foodstuffs they couldn't move, they would destroy. And then, of course, the animals. So you're literally the shirt on your back, and winter's coming. And I'll tell you, we just don't know. It's like I say, the dead tell no tales, do they?
Yeah, and the victors get to tell the story.
The thing strikes me too, Cal and Mike, is that the striking thing to me got me, of course, my mind racing on the subject here in so many directions. But that culture, having brushed aside in the years of the war, which is, I want to say, 61 to 65, so it's more or less 5 years, brushed aside any limiter, any governor on its evolution, if you will. And to me, the metaphor of a mold or a bacteria that is shorn of its natural enemies now, and no antibodies, no antigens attacking it, and it just blooms. And that, the product of that over several generations is the culture of the federal bureaucrat today. And their capacity, to my mind, I've known a number of them, and they're worse in real life than anything us would-be pundits can come up with. I tell you, they have a darkness about them a lot. I'm talking about federal police. They have a font of hatred for our entire culture, the dissident culture, which is pretty vestigial in this country, but they have an instant hatred as though we are a foreign mortal enemy, like an overseas type of threat, like a Chinese ICBM launching type of threat. And, it erupts. I know you guys have seen it. I'm not sure about you, Cal, because I don't know your personal history, but Mike, I'm sure in your travels and bumping up against the BLM and other people that you've seen this. You remember some of the beauties right down there around Cortez, Colorado, and your neck of the woods, like Agent Love, that type of a person. To me, he's the guy who ran that antiquities raid down the Four Corners area in the western states, and which resulted in deaths. And there were helicopter assaults on these people holding pieces of clay that they shouldn't have been had in their homes and what have you. But you've seen it, Mike, that almost animal-like hatred, that knee-jerk hatred that comes out as soon as you identify yourself as not a union man.
Oh, very much so. And you mentioned that Agent Love. Have any of you two gentlemen read the transcripts of that trial down in Blanding, Utah?
No. Is this the same Love that was at Bundy?
Yes.
Same guy.
Most definitely. And he now has been forcibly retired, I believe. Is that correct, Mike?
That is correct. And he testified in that trial in Oregon that the BLM and other federal units actually had hit lists of American patriots, that the government had compiled a hit list. And he actually testified to that. And what did the press do with it? Not a damn thing.
Yeah, that's lovely. Why aren't I surprised?
Well, you know, that's one of the things, guys, and I got hooked on that back with the Randy Weaver deal. Because I was just terribly interested in what happened in that trial. And I thought, well, you know, there's no way in hell that we're ever going to know the truth about what happened in that trial. Because I had remembered what William Casey said back in 82 when he said, we will know that our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. And then when you had Colby come along later as director of the CIA and admit in a congressional hearing, we own everyone of any significant value in the major media. They're open with it, and they tell this, and Americans still think they're going to get the truth? This is what amazed me, but I wanted to know what happened, and so I made an investment way back in the 90s, and I ordered the transcripts of the complete trial of Harris and Weaver. And it was incredible. The federal government was found in contempt by a federal judge 7 times during that Weaver trial. Lon Horiuchi was exposed for exactly what he did. How many people know that he was questioned and he was said, okay, what does it take to become a sniper on the hostage rescue team of the FBI? And he said, oh, well, we have to be able to hit a target at 300 meters. We have to be able to do this. And then he was asked, well, how far away was Vicki Weaver from your point? And he said, oh, about 60 yards.
Jeez,
and then he was asked, but your testimony is that you were shooting at Mr. Harris and you missed and hit Vicki Weaver in the face. How can a person with that kind of marksmanship make that kind of mistake? And then later, it was proved and brought in as evidence, which they were, the federal government was found in contempt, was brought in where Horiuchi had drawn an after-action report where he drew a stick figure of Vicky Weaver and had put the crosshairs on her head. But he had testified that, I missed a shot. I was aiming at Mr. Harris. Bull crap. And then the next day, the very next day, the FBI on a loudspeaker says to Randy Weaver, "Hey, Randy, we're having pancakes for breakfast this morning. What's Vicky having?"
Yeah.
Now, that does that not speak to the madness that you're talking about, Dale?
Well, it goes on and on. You know, I can remember reading Gary Spence's book. I can't remember the title of it. I think that's his first name, but the attorney that handled Randy's lawsuit.
Yes.
And in the text of that, there are transcript. There is printed out the transcript in part of communications of between senior ATF people while they're still airborne. You know, transiting to the area in fixed wing aircraft. You know. Owned by the government, but talking to their subordinates on the ground about who, what the rules of engagement would be, and again, it's just warfare language. They might as well be talking about, I don't know, you know, who, what kind of Germans to kill in 1944 or 45. So. They wanted to do much more in terms of firepower on the house. They wanted to incinerate those people. Do I recollect that correctly?
Yes, and your mention of what Jerry Spence brought out, which was just absolutely classic, was in those rules of engagement, which they discussed on their flight to Idaho. Was when the FBI hostage rescue team had been told that the leader of the family was Vicky Weaver, not Randy
right.
Weaver.
She's that keeping the leader, them together.
The leader of the family was Vicky Weaver, and she should be their primary target. Who did they shoot in the face?
Yeah, yeah.
An unarmed woman.
Yeah, and of course, the significance of it is that we're on this long sequence starting before the Civil War, even what a lot of senior people in the U.S. government wanted to do, the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion was no better, or the participants in the Whiskey Rebellion. There were just draconian, there were senior people who wanted to have executions over that. So
Hamilton.
We're on a long roll here, and the culmination of it is going to be a thing to behold. I don't think you have to be a genius to figure that out, because there's never been any pushback, never been any significant pushback.
Well, when has any of these federal officials, let's stop and look at, after the congressional investigations into Waco and Ruby Ridge, the FBI leaders of both projects were promoted. One of them received a $60,000 bonus.
Indeed. And the ATF was expanded, and the new ATF director gave a incredibly militant, defiant speech talking about how post-Waco there was murmuring throughout the bureaucracy that the agency might have to be disbanded, and that there was all of this criticism and second-guessing, and that the department lived through that and now thrives and will be manned, something like have double the manpower in the next 4 years. It was a great inaugural speech that this bastard, you know, came out with in reveling in the survival of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and in the fact that it was gaining in influence, gaining in power and manpower and its fiscal support and all the rest of it. So you know, it's a debacle. The whole thing, there's been absolutely no justice, and people keep asking today, well, when, you know, when is something going to happen about this to reverse this tyranny growing, this medically based tyranny? Well,
never.
What do you expect? What the hell does anybody expect? Nothing was done. In fact, just the opposite. The perpetrators were rewarded for these debacles that happened in the 90s. And so this has to happen. What's about to happen now, which is internment and displacement of noncompliant peoples or people, that it's an absolute must to happen, because nothing rose up in the populace in a resistant way to these other things.
Well, Dale, you brought up something very interesting there about the comeback of the BATF after Waco. Well, let's not forget that within just a couple of years, who supported the hiring of 500 new BATF agents and legions of federal prosecutors to prosecute gun crimes?
Well, I don't know who you
have NRA.
In mind, Mike, but I'm going to guess it's a Republican.
Well, it's the National Rifle Association.
Yeah, the NRA.
Oh, you knew, Cal. You knew.
Yeah.
I'll be damned. Yeah.
Well, Cal, where did you learn that, Cal?
I figured that one out for myself.
Oh,
and then,
great!
You know, you reconfirmed it. It's like, wait a minute. The NRA is supporting all this stuff. I mean, what pointed it out to me is the NRA was the driving force behind concealed carry permits, which is just voluntary surrender of your natural right to arms. And saying, okay, the government can decide if I can have arms or not. And that's exactly what a concealed carry permit does.
Well, guys, let's go.
And I don't need permission from the government to properly exercise any of my rightful liberty. I don't know how the government doesn't understand that. And I don't understand how my fellow man doesn't understand that.
Well, Cal, let's go back to the year 2007. When the a member of the U.S. Congress proposed H.R. 1022, which I found an interesting number. But what did H.R. 1022, what was the proposition? It did not pass, but it was proposed, and the NRA supported it. What would 1022, House Resolution 1022 have done?
Was that a national reciprocity bill?
No. 1022 in 2007 would have denied ownership of firearms to any veteran who had ever been counseled for PTSD issues. The NRA supported that.
That doesn't surprise me.
Well, the NRA has also been, you can tell there's no real scrutiny on them, except for some of the other legitimate gun organizations try to publicize the infamy that the NRA practices. But you can tell that there's not much concern because of the way they consume contributions and redistribute them to such a small little clique of people at the top of the organization. They're not worried at all about public scrutiny.
Well, the NRA stands for no rights anymore.
Well, I was just pointing out how a lot of Americans just don't do their due diligence in understanding the forces of tyranny against us. And NRA has become an instrument of it, in my opinion. It's just another form of controlled opposition.
Well, guys, some crazy rebel wrote an article about 20 years ago about the NRA. And it was called True Defenders of Liberty or Government Lapdogs. You guys got any idea who that crazy guy might have been?
Yeah, probably that rebel madman guy. Real crazy dude.
Yeah, I've heard about him. He has some serious mental issues.
Yeah, he's got a website out there too called rebelmadman.org in case anybody else wants to read up on how crazy he is. Which I would encourage you to read up what he's wrote just so you can decide for yourself just how crazy he really is. Instead of taking my word for it, just read it for yourself. Prove me wrong. Read his articles.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny. I was just looking to see exactly when I wrote that article, and I know it was over 20 years ago. I believe it was in 2001. I don't know if I can find a copy of it now or not, guys. I'm trying to put all my old stuff together. I'm going to try to publish everything I have on the new website of everything that I've ever written. I want to try to get it all posted on rebelmadman.org, and then I want to bring in rebelmadman.com to be kind of a show notes kind of page. Dale, did we lose you again? Well, I tell you what, they just don't like Dale for some reason. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I find him to be a very nice guy.
Well, he lives just down the road from the, you know, the NSA Super Center.
Yeah, well, so, as a matter
of fact, he's real close. You know, he's probably got some guy who's, you know, just in a bad mood today and got cut Dale off.
Well, it might have been. I actually have a video of Dale Williams actually out there protesting the building of that NRA site. Do you remember that, Dale?
Yeah, you're coming in loud and clear now, Mike. Which site are we talking about?
Oh, when you were out there leading the opposition to the NRA collection site out there near Salt Lake.
NSA.
Yeah, that's the
NSA. I'm sorry.
Sure. Yeah. No, I knew what you mean. That's the NSA data center, and I've always heard that there's a sister site, a mirror site, in outside of Austin. Never really looked into it, but apparently. The U.S. government feels like two is one is none.
Yeah, very much so. And this is the thing that everyone out there, I do not think, stop and think why your government feels like that they should take your money forcibly, and if you don't surrender it, you can go to jail or be killed, to build a facility to monitor every keystroke you make on your phone, every conversation you have on your phone, everything you do on your computer. And that is one of the reasons that I became apoplectic with laughter when they said that Hillary had private servers that nobody could monitor. Really? The NSA had everything that Hillary had ever written, and for the FBI to say they couldn't recover it is just total blatant bullshit. Pardon my French.
I think that alleged, you know, utterance that she made on election night 2016 to the effect that, hey, if these people win, we're all going to hang. I think that's another piece of hysterically funny fiction. I mean, the Clintons don't hang. They hang people. And to my mind, I mean, my reality model has the Clintons as completely untouchable. I know that's.
Well, we lost him again. Boy, this is beginning to be fun. He's really on some.
He's really got his handler out there at the NSA. He's having a hard time keeping up with Dale getting back on air.
Yeah. Oh, it's almost funny when we watch it, what they do to try to silence us, isn't it? I guess these are the Facebook guys that have found out what Dale is saying is incorrect.
I talk from this location on using this device without any interference day after day after day, so for what it's worth. Anyhow, go ahead.
Yeah, but the problem is you're not talking to me.
That's right. Yeah, you might, Mike, you might teach me how they light a firecracker in special forces, and God forbid, right? You know, that's it's so. I mean, good God. I mean, we're all old men here. What are they worried about, right? I assume you're an old man, Cal.
I are.
Yeah.
I are.
Yeah.
No, well, we're not. We're not too much of a threat. At least I'm not. I'm never getting cut off, so everything I say just must be irrelevant to them.
How many young people do you know that discuss the things we discuss, gentlemen? That might answer your question.
Goose?
Yeah, Goose is about it, I think.
That's about it.
The pond I swim in is the so-called alternative media, Mike, and I really never, almost never, get down to the foundational pathogens, you know, the pathogenic issues with the foundation of the country, the founding of the country. I just don't hear it discussed. And that's what I was trying to say last time we got together, is about the work.
They got him again.
They got him again. Well, he was mentioned. I just want to make a point. He was talking about, you know, the rise of the ATFE after Randy Weaver. Patrick Henry warned of this, of the federal sheriffs. He said this is what's going to happen. And that's why, you know, part of this is like it's a shock, but really it's not a shock if you understand how governments operate. What's happening really could be predicted, because Patrick Henry predicted it clear back in 1787 and 88.
How'd they know?
Because, oh, they studied history.
Oh, and they didn't study Marxist history.
No, they studied history as they knew history. They looked at history, looked at the proclivities of man, or man's, you know, the way man behaves, and they were able to see what was going to happen.
Dale,
not
you still
in exact
with us?
Detail, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Mike. And Cal, by that time, didn't the British East India Company, which I take it was the action arm of the European banks, or at least the Bank of England, didn't they have the system down that's operating today? The system.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So the whole template is already in place, and we're just watching it being practiced by people like Colby and the other folks. Mike has mentioned the CIA people.
Well, one of the things that, you know, to point out is way back when the Bank of London or Bank of England started and all that, they actually still had to deal in real money back then, in specie. I mean, that was part of the problem where the Whiskey Rebellion happened, or more so the Shays, you know, the Shays Rebellion, because, you know, they didn't have actual specie to pay the taxes they owned, and that's what the government required. So they didn't have that. But that specie, or so-called currency, which is now the U.S. Treasury note, is going away, and it's going to be completely digital coming in the future. And once that, since the central bankers who've been at this since for centuries, once they have that, I don't see how you can stop them, because they control the digital world. And everybody's in the digital world anymore. So I don't see how you're going to stop them now.
Wouldn't digital currency be the ultimate form of specie, the most efficient conceivable form of it?
In terms of exchange, yes. In terms of who can control it, no. So it's a two-edged sword. I mean, I can get money to you, you know, digitally if I needed to in an instant, you know, or if I wanted to mail you a $100 bill, I'd have to stick it in the mail and hope the mail could get it to you. So it has a pro to it, but the big con is that they control it. And if they control the money, they control the people. And this is all about control. I mean, think about it. People who pay taxes, they could print up the taxes that you supposedly owe.
Yeah,
the only reason they charge you taxes is to keep you under control. That's the only reason they have you pay taxes.
When they abolish the more or less wild west of cryptos that's extant at this point, and you go over to government sanctioned digital currency, you've got a system perfected. I mean, to the advantages of
of that specie offered have come into a state of near perfection at that point in terms of control and coercion and punishing not the non-compliant and essentially outlawing human beings in the old-fashioned sense of like the Romans used to do, where you couldn't give somebody that was condemned shelter, water, or food for 400 miles from this location or whatever. So,
guys, we don't have a
form of control. It is.
Thanks, Cal. Well, you and Dale, we don't have a lot of time left here, and I just wanted to point out a couple of things. We were talking about John Singleton Mosby. I wanted to leave with the fact that John Singleton Mosby never surrendered. His Rangers never surrendered. They disbanded, but they refused to surrender even after Lee had surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse. And that is the true spirit of the Southern white man, in my opinion. And so I would like to tell folks, too, that I have two Telegram channels, Rebel Madman and Constitutional Fraud. And I can't thank you guys enough for participating. Dale, we've had a tag team going here trying to get you back on several occasions, but I'm happy that you were able to join us for this last hour. Thank you for doing that, sir.
So happy to be here. And good luck to you, Cal.
Thanks, Dale. It's great having you on. You're more than welcome on here anytime.
Thank you.
Well, you want to kind of sum us up here, Cal?
Well, I guess studying, people like Mosby, it shows a man who was able to adapt to the situations on the ground like Stonewall was and take advantage of necessities that needed to be done in wartime to conduct a guerrilla warfare to halt the overpowering, dominant federal sheriff's force, so to speak. So there are lessons to be learned from Mosby's raid and what he did and the tactics he used. This is all part of the stuff that Sun Tzu, if you haven't read Art of War, I would suggest it. Because I guarantee the enemy has.
Well, that would be true. Dale, thanks again, buddy. I wish you nothing but the best. Cal, thanks forever for coming on with us. Looks like our music's coming up, folks. Thanks for listening in to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the first Friday in 2022. Thanks again. Everyone take care.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
18-0-5-1-7-3. We talk about decentralization and...